Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, as he does every Monday morning. And we've also got the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress is in Toronto at the Toronto International Film Festival. He will not be joining us this morning, but he is going to be joining us tomorrow to review some of the films that he's seen up in Toronto. But Steve Procopi is here, and he will be joining me for the Monday morning movie reviews, and I'll do some box office as well. Also coming up on the show, we are going to talk about some bizarre origins behind popular songs, and we've got some ridiculous origins of brand names and much more. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Again, Eric will be joining us tomorrow from Toronto. He will not be joining us for the Monday morning movie reviews, which we're going to get started right now with Steve Procopi. Steve, how are you?
Hey, good. Hey, Nick.
Good. Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So we were off last week for the the Labor Day. So there's a couple that we missed. I'm really curious about you mentioned this one briefly a couple of weeks ago. Love and Tasha.
Yeah.
This is the documentary about Anton Yelchin, correct?
Right, which I'm not even sure is still in theaters right now. I think it was only out for a week at the Landmark, but I just want to make sure people find it somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a million ways to do it these days. You can find it sooner or later. This one hit me really, really personally, because there were a couple times in 2011 where I was lucky enough to meet Anton Yelchin, once at the beginning of the year at South by Southwest before the world premiere of The Beaver, Jodie Foster's film.
Yeah.
And he was tremendous, although I kind of had my sights set on to talk to her that night. And then in October, during the Chicago International Film Festival, he was here with Felicity Jones for a movie that he made called Like Crazy, which, according to this film, this documentary, is a was a really important film for him professionally. But he was barely in his 20s when I met him, and 5 years later, at the age of 27, he was gone, and he was killed in, like, the most freakish of car accidents. So, but people still talk about him very fondly in terms of the legacy he left behind, in terms of performances, as well as just the tons of friendships that will live on well past his time on Earth. But this film, Love Antosha, is from a first-time feature director named Garrett Price, and it really just sort of details Yelchin making these fast and lasting friendships with people, but none of them compared to the closeness that he had with his Russian immigrant parents, who were former figure skating champions, especially his mother. They were very, very close, and not in a sort of stage mom kind of way. Both parents were very supportive of his choice to be an actor when he was a very young kid. Actually, it was right after his dad started showing him some classic films, maybe age-inappropriate films like Taxi Driver, for example, when he was about 7 or 8. So, but the filmmakers had complete access to Yelchin's home movies and personal journals. Actually, the journal entries are read of all people, Nicolas Cage, which seems weird, but it actually kind of works, even though I think he's old enough to be his dad. So,
yeah.
And then there's interviews with some of his oldest and closest friends and his parents, by the time you're like in this film, it feels like immersive and complete, and it's not just about his career highlights. He was born in the Soviet Union, but he came to the U.S. when he was about 6 months old, and like I said, he decided around the age of 11 that he wanted to be an actor, and when he was still just a little kid, he's acting opposite like Anthony Hopkins in Hearts in Atlantis and Morgan Freeman in Along Came a Spider and Albert Finney in some movie called Delivering Milo, which I don't think I ever saw. But he's just like, and he's not just like in these movies with them, he's going like toe to toe with them. But there's also these incredible stories by, there's a great story that Kristen Stewart tells. They were in a movie together called Fierce People. And I guess she was just sort of madly in love with him, even though she was only about 14. And then they stayed close. after that, and then something happened, and they don't exactly say what. Where, as she put it, he broke her heart, and which is sad. And but she still clearly thinks the world of him. But then years later, when he had his first serious girlfriend, and his first serious girlfriend broke up with him, he called Kristen Stewart and he goes, "Hey, remember that thing you said I did to you? Well, now I understand it, and I'm really sorry that I did that to you." And she was so unbelievably moved by that, and that's the kind of guy he was. And it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy. There's another story that Jennifer Lawrence tells. They were in a couple. They were actually in those two movies, The Beaver and Like Crazy, together. And she noticed that every time there was a new take, he would change it up. Like, he would do something slightly different in the performance each time. And she mentioned this to him, and she's like, "Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do to give the director options." And she goes, "Oh, I just do the same thing each time." And he's like, "Yeah, I noticed." And so and that was sort of his nice way of saying, maybe you should maybe mix it up a little. And she said that was the minute, that was the second when she realized, oh, I should probably do this different each time. And she said it changed her acting career. Like, it clearly it did. But anyway, and like, you know, they go into all his films, of course, like Alpha Dog and Charlie Bartlett, and of course, and really his great performance in Fright Night, which is a movie that I love.
Yeah.
Only Lovers Left Alive, Jarmusch's film, and of course the three Star Trek films, and where he made some of his closest friends, and everyone in that those films is interviewed here, as well as J.J. Abrams. But then it also dives into his personal hobbies, things like he was a musician. He was a great photographer and took some really crazy experimental photos of some of the darker, seedier sides of L.A., and that's a whole other part of him that I knew nothing about. It's really fascinating. He like I said, he played in a band regularly, and of course that sort of made him really want to be in that movie Green Room, which is, I think, still one of his best performances.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And at the time of his death, even, he had like six or seven unreleased movies, most of which made their way sort of quietly into art house theaters over the next couple of years, and one of your favorites, Thoroughbreds, is one of them. Love Antosha sort of confirms that Yelchin's best work was probably still ahead of him. He was just gearing up to direct his first film when he died. But even the filmography he has now, at 27, was still very, very impressive. And then there's this sort of sheer volume of love and admiration people had for him. That he had for the creative process. He was a student of film. He was a student of everything that he got interested in. So he could talk your ear off any subject, practically. And that's what I remember about him. Is I don't even remember what we talked about, but I know that we were just like, he was engaged and interested and curious. And if nothing else, the film is a testament to the power of having really supportive parents. So who doted on him without being clingy, like I said. Be prepared to cry and be introduced to a side of Yelchin that you never really knew existed. He had sort of an illness that his whole life that he kept secret. I don't want to give too much away about that because it weirdly connected to the way he died, although not responsible for it. Everything that this film does is something I had hoped for and more, and I was in no way disappointed. It's a great film. Seek it out. It's called Love Antosha.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was a terrific actor, man.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned Thoroughbreds. I loved him in that movie.
Yeah.
He was hilarious.
Yeah.
in that film, and I loved him in everything. I couldn't believe it when I heard the story about his passing. I just was like, what? How does something like that happen? A real tragic.
Part of one interview with Simon Pegg, who was just beside himself, even years later, trying to understand how something so stupid is the thing that kills this incredible person. I mean, it really was just a freak accident. And it wasn't like he was smashed to death by his own car. It just like pushed into him enough that he couldn't breathe anymore. That's really what happened. It's unbelievable.
It's
unbelievable. And the movie's great. The movie's terrific.
Okay.
Find it, please.
Love Antosha. Okay. Steve, hang on.
Yep.
All right, Steve Procopio is with us, and we've got more movies to review. We're playing catch-up from last week when we were off for Labor Day, but we got a few more movies to review. Again, Eric will be joining us tomorrow. He is into Toronto at the film festival right now, and he can't. His schedule is pretty crazy right now, but he'll be with us tomorrow. All right, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood. Player
right.
Of sea.
Welcome back. Yeah. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. It is Monday, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a Monday, and it's a jokey time. Lots of other stuff we're going to be talking about as well, origins behind some popular songs and some ridiculous origins of brand names, and much more. 312-981-7200 for talk or text, 312-981-7200. Eric Childress is not with us this morning. He is in Toronto at the Toronto International Film Festival. His schedule is pretty crazy, but he will be joining us tomorrow on the show to give us some reviews of some of the things that he is seeing in Toronto. And Steve Procopio is here. Hey, Steve.
Hello.
Now, what, you usually go to Toronto, don't you?
I don't actually. No,
oh.
I've never been. It just, when I, in all the years I was at Ain't It Cool News, we had guys that lived in Toronto, so they had it covered. They didn't need me there, so
oh, okay.
I never got. That was like pretty much sometimes the only thing that they did for us every year. So we kind of, I didn't want to step on their toes, but
oh, okay.
I would love to go sometime. Believe me.
Now you go, but you go to Sundance every year, right?
I go to Sundance. Up until recently, I went to South by Southwest every year. I'll probably get back to doing that pretty soon. Yeah, I go to like Fantasia, which is a big genre festival in Montreal every year. So I make my rounds.
All
yeah.
right. Okay. Cool. Now I did not get a chance to see Midsommar, the director's cut.
No.
what more could there be?
It's, you know what, I'm not going out on a limb here, because I think everyone who's seen it thinks it's actually, I think, a little bit better. There's about 25 minutes more in this version.
Wow.
So it's pushing 3 hours at this point. It's about as long as It Chapter 2, actually. but I will say there's only one, like, legitimate, from what I could remember, because, I mean, this came out when, beginning of July, right?
Yeah.
There's one big scene that was not in the film we saw that was right after the, I'll call it the cliff diving scene, where it's another ceremony that involves a lake and strapping a big boulder to a child's chest and getting ready to throw that child in the lake. And so... and it plays out, it plays out a little differently than the scene before. It might lead you to believe it would, but it's still a really important scene because something that a visual element of that scene shows up later in the film in the version we saw, but it didn't really make sense in that version, and now it makes a little more sense. And there's a bunch of that, but most of what's here is sort of just scene extensions, and there's definitely a little more graphic violence in it, if that's even possible. I'm pretty sure we get a couple more hammer strokes in that one scene. But then there's also, from what I can remember, there's a few flashbacks that Florence Pugh's character, Danny, has, to her parents' death, or versions of it she sees in her head, since I don't think she ever actually saw it, but she has a sort of nightmarish versions of it. And so what the cumulative effect is that it sort of adds to her. We get a little bit more insight into her mental state at various points in this trip. There's also a lot more discussion of these dueling theses that Jack Rayner and William Jackson Harper are like fighting about. They're going to do a thesis on this civilization, and there's a bit more of that fighting, and so we realize how much those guys were actually at each other's throats. What we don't get, and I'm really glad, is that there are characters in the film that, you know, they vanish at various points, and we don't see them for a while, and then we kind of find out what happened to them much later on. And I was afraid they were going to fill in some of those gaps, and thankfully they don't. It's just like somebody disappears, and then they kind of show up somewhere later in some state that is not alive. And there's sort of a mystery to that still is left. But I think overall it's not that it's clearer, but some of the motivations are clear. I think some of the psychological damage that is being done by this couple to each other is a little clearer. It certainly feels, I felt it a little more deeply this time. So I assume it's coming out at some point, on home video or some other way. But if you were a fan of Midsommar, I think you definitely owe it to yourself to seek this version out just to see what else was there.
Yeah. Well, I will, because I happen to think the movie's great. So
yeah. Oh, for sure.
All right. All right, Steve, tell us about, Brittany Runs a Marathon.
Love this one. Speaking of Sundance Film Festival, this was a very much talked about film at Sundance, and it also, the second screening of it ever was at the Chicago Critics Film Festival in May. So it's a self-improvement, body-positive comedy featuring the very, very funny Jillian Bell, who we just saw a few weeks ago in the Marc Maron film Sword of Trust. This is her first leading role. It's written and directed by a playwright named Paul Downs Colaizzo, who is making his feature debut here. The movie centers on a 27-year-old woman named Brittany, based on a real person that the writer knows. She sort of hit a dead end in her life that includes a somewhat scary health diagnosis from her doctor, and she decides to make some changes by taking up running, and which eventually turns into a sort of a full-blown training session for the New York City Marathon. During the course of her training, the health benefits turn out to be sort of the least interesting thing about her transformation. She makes some new friends and running buddies. She stands up for herself a lot more in confrontational situations. She starts to take a lot more responsibility for some of the negative outlook she has sometimes about herself and others and just her life in general. The film has a lot of laughs, believe me. Bell's has incredible timing and delivery, and she's great. But she also handles the really dramatic moments really impressively. And like I said, she was in Sword of Trust when she was played half of a lesbian married couple with Michaela Watkins, who was also in this film as her across the hall neighbor and running buddy. They form a really great friendship that I loved. She also makes a gay best friend. What's interesting about the characters in Brittany Runs a Marathon is that in any other movie, these would be sidekicks to somebody else. And basically what we get is a collection of sidekicks from other films. There's, you know, an annoying roommate, there's a brother and sister, and there's a sister and brother-in-law, there's a possible love interest, but this is not a rom-com, believe me. And it sort of gives each of these one-time sidekicks their own moments and backstories and series of flaws and motivations, and in the end we don't really get any side characters. They all kind of mean something to us by the end of this film. It's almost like watching a magic trick, and you kind of wonder why no one's really tried this before. Like I mentioned, there is a potential love interest, and what I loved about the love interest is that it's not the having a boyfriend is not looked at as some sort of reward for losing weight, and it's also not looked at sort of as a cure-all for all her personal problems and mental problems. It is definitely not that, and she doesn't look at it as that. there's a real great moment of clarity that comes to her through her brother-in-law, who's played by Lil Rel Howery, who who's the only person in her life to really deliver tough love when she desperately needs it. And he says something to her about, you know, the running was never really about the weight loss, and that's kind of the beautiful thing about this movie. And there's a moment where she is injured, and so she can't run for a while, and it really freaks her out, and you almost watch her backslide and become a really horrible person for a part of this movie. And thankfully, she's able to pull out of that. But it's a feel good story by any definition. But one that anyone who's ever sort of set out to accomplish the seemingly impossible is sure to appreciate. I love this movie. I love the way it balances the comedy and the drama. And it's a beautiful little film. It is not preachy. It is not corny. It is very believable and wonderful. And I hope people get out and see it. It looks like people are, but yeah, you definitely go check it out.
Yeah. Hang on, Steve. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of it. Steve Procopi is with us. Eric is in Toronto. He'll be stopping in tomorrow to give us some reviews of some of the stuff that he's seeing up there. But we'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Brittany Runs a Marathon. We got more movies to review right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress is in Toronto at the Toronto International Film Festival, and we'll hear from him tomorrow with the latest reviews of things that he's seen up there. Steve Procopi is with us to handle the Monday morning movie reviews. We'll do the box office as well. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
You were just talking about Brittany Runs a Marathon.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't agree with you more. It is just a lovely movie. And she's so good in it. I mean, I've always been a fan of hers, but she's been stuck in some crappy movies. But I've always liked her. I've always thought she was really, you know, wonderful. And this is just a great piece for her. And she runs with it, no pun intended. But it's you know, it's fun to watch her, a bunch of great, you know, supporting characters in this movie. And, you know, you mentioned Michaela Watkins, who has really carved this great sort of career as this really acerbic and very, very funny supporting performer, you know, and she shows up in a lot of great stuff. I mean, you know, she was fantastic on Enlightened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the best thing that ever happened to her was getting canned on SNL.
yeah.
It's the best thing ever happened to her. And she's just great in this. And they have a wonderful chemistry. This is a showcase for Jillian Bell, though, and she's really terrific in it. And you're right. There's that section of the movie where it's like, wait, I don't think I like this person anymore. But no, there's a lot going on here. And it's a feel good movie that makes you feel good. And you can pretty much identify with not just her plight, but a lot of the plights of the people in the movie. A very, very, very enjoyable movie. And I highly, highly recommend it. It's Brittany Runs a Marathon with Jillian Bell, who I think will get a lot more recognition after this movie, which is richly deserved. So,
you know, she's about to make a remake of Splash with Channing Tatum as the mermaid.
Yeah, that's what I read about. Who's behind that? Do we know who the director is?
I will look it up as we continue.
Okay, all right.
I feel like I should know this. I did just popped in my head when you mentioned.
No, no, I know that that she is doing. I forgot that she was involved, but I knew that Channing Tatum was actually the mermaid or the mermaid.
She's the Tom Hanks character.
Yeah, she's the Tom Hanks character. All right. Well, let's get up to this week's movies now. I wasn't even aware that there was a Super Size Me 2.
Well, this actually premiered at Toronto like 2 years ago, like two Torontos ago, and it just kind of sat on the shelf.
Yeah.
I think Morgan Spurlock may have gotten a little Me Too trouble back then.
I think that's
what maybe delayed it, but he, I may have it wrong, but I seem to remember he might have even, like, I don't think the person who, I don't think the person actually accused him. I think she came to him and he outed himself to the world, because he felt so bad about it. So, so that may have something to do with the fact that this is coming out at all. And I'm glad it is, because, you know, there's a lot of people that say that Michael Moore is the guy that, the documentarians whose films most successfully blend politics and activism with humor and entertainment. But I actually, my vote kind of goes for Morgan Spurlock, who broke through in 2004 with an Oscar-nominated takedown of the fast food industry called Super Size Me. And he's tackled a variety of subjects over the years, in the 15 years since, maybe not quite as hard-hitting as that, but Spurlock clearly believes that Super Size Me had an impact on the fast food world, because shortly after it was released, a lot of chains began to emphasize their healthier menu items, and or at least discovered a long list of buzzwords and phrases that made it sound like they had healthier options. And that's really, this isn't a movie that sort of dissects factory farming, or, you know, in any of the things that maybe Fast Food Nation did, the book, I mean. But instead he is more looking at the way that fast food chains and as he calls it, big chicken, the handful of companies that basically run the chicken industry have sort of warped the use of language and even the designs of their restaurants to make us feel like we're eating healthier, even if we're still eating the same crap. So anyway, he decides that he, instead of just retreading what we got in the first film, he decides he's going to open up his own chicken restaurant. And by opening his restaurant and only serving variations of chicken-based meals, he uses the opportunity to be as transparent and hopefully healthy as he possibly can be, while still opening up a business that he really does want to keep open and possibly even franchise. And while the filmmaker goes through the surprisingly difficult process of buying his own chickens and finding a place to raise them, arranging to make his restaurant the only farm-to-table fast food joint in operation, and he eventually has to find a place, which ends up being in Ohio, he meets a lot of resistance along the way, again, mostly because of Big Chicken, companies like Tyson and Purdue, who don't like that he's doing this, and calling them out on some of their crap. So they try to block certain aspects of his new operation, which is always fun to watch happen. But along the way, he also sort of skillfully inserts more personal stories about generations-old family chicken farms that are being cheated out of large sums of money by these corporations as a routine part of business, while also diving into just how useless the USDA is these days. And like I said before, like a battery of healthy buzzwords that really don't have any meaning. Spurlock kind of debunks or clears up definitions of claims like free range and all natural and organic, cage free, stress free, even hormone free is a useless term, because apparently it's 100% illegal to use hormones in any meat that we eat. So that doesn't really mean anything to say that's hormone free. He also tours various fast food restaurants to look at how they're attempting to redesign their layouts to have more wood so it looks more like a barn, and because somehow that means it's all like a farm, has some sort of farm connotation. It's how restaurants have changed the word fried to crispy, the way that they sandwich, literally, like in quotes, sandwich images of unhealthy food between pictures of salads in the restaurants. I mean, it's amazing. They create something, it's called a health halo that basically just makes you feel like you're walking into an aura of healthiness. I can guarantee you will never walk into another fast food restaurant or see another commercial for fast food and not be able to notice these things after you see this movie. The whole thing leads up to the grand opening of Spurlock's restaurant, and I won't ruin any of the really fun surprises that await the customers who walk in the doors. They are offered up locally sourced water, a.k.a. tap water. That's one big thing he offers. But the content and promise of Spurlock's restaurant might be the highlight of any of his films. It's so great what he's done in that restaurant. And it shows what a masterful satirist the guy can be that he's turned into in the last 15 years. He keeps us laughing while also keeping us mildly terrified of the way that food industries run aspects of our lives. And he also makes it clear that some of the fault lies with us for not being better consumers. So, we know this, we just sometimes don't care. But we also know that fried chicken tastes better than grilled chicken. So that's part of the problem. But like I said, it's not a retread of anything he's done before. There have been certainly documentaries recently that have covered factory farming and things like that. But this is a little different. It's really entertaining. It's very educational, and it will outrage you as much as it will make you laugh. And I believe it's playing for a 2-week run at the Gene Siskel Film Center, which is pretty rare. So you have plenty of opportunities to check it out.
Okay, so that's Super Size Me 2, Holy Chicken.
Yes. I won't say what that refers to. That actually is a reference to something in the film, but I don't want to ruin it.
Okay.
Because apparently it's a secret.
Okay. All right. And so this just sat on the shelf for a couple of years.
After Toronto, at least. Yeah, I don't know when it was originally, if it was ever had a release date, but I'm glad it's sneaking out.
Okay.
It's really solid.
Okay, good. Steve, hang on.
Yep.
All right. Steve Procopi is with us and reviewing the new movies. He's got a couple more to review here, and we'll do that right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the WGN Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time, and we are also going to talk about some ridiculous origins of brand names, and also some of the bizarre origins of popular songs. So there it is. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, if you would like to join us. Eric Childress is in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival. He will not be able to join us this morning, but he will join us tomorrow for reviews of many of the films that he's seen up there. But Steve Procopi is with us for the Monday morning movie reviews. And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay. Tell us about Official Secrets.
Right. Well, oftentimes when a dramatic film attempts to retell a true life story, it takes certain liberties with facts and characters to make it work and seem more cinematic, and that's fine most of the time. That's fine. But if you're a stickler for the undiluted truth, you're welcome to take in as many documentaries as you can fit in your eye holes, and you will literally never run out if you start right now. Now, I don't know if there are any, co-writer, director Gavin Hood, I don't know if his film Official Secrets strays far from the facts, but he has constructed what I believe is a deliberately dry but fairly accurate account of a British government intelligence specialist who blew the whistle on her government back in 2003. She recognized that her office was being told to help the United States gather blackmail material on certain UN Security Council members from nations who were not cooperating in passing a resolution that would have fully sanctioned the U.S. to go to war against Iraq. In other words, they were being asked to sell the world on an illegal war, in her eyes. As a result of her discovery, and she was a translator who listened in to recordings of wiretaps from for the purposes of government-sanctioned spying. So, I mean, she was a spy. Catherine Gunn, who's played by Keira Knightley, took an NSA memo about this blackmail scenario and through various underground channels got it to the news or the Observer newspaper, which set off a firestorm of political intrigue and embarrassed a great number of government people on both sides of the Atlantic. Gunn was not a secret anti-war advocate or a whistleblower, traditional whistleblower, or an agitator of any kind. To her, the case was clear. The U.S. was lying about Iraq being a threat to the world and was dragging Britain along for the ride because it could. She was eventually branded a traitor and thrown in prison and she has an immigrant husband who was a Kurd who was put in great danger of being deported because of this. He was not part of her decision to steal the memo and didn't even know about it till after it was done. But Official Secrets isn't just her story. Gavin Hood, who you might know from things like Eye in the Sky, and he did a great film a few years ago called Satsi. But, of course, he also did X-Men Origins Wolverine, which we won't discuss.
Yeah.
And we're just going to have to give him a pass on that one. Anyway, he spends a great deal of time in this film in the offices of the Observer as the staff sort of thoroughly researches the credibility of the memo and figures out the best way to write up this sort of earth-shattering story. Matt Smith is in this, playing a reporter who first receives the memo without knowing who it's from. Reese Ifans is in the thing as another reporter who has been looking for ways to poke holes in the U.S.'s claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Conleth Hill from Game of Thrones plays the editor, Roger Alton, who is concerned that the paper has already come out in favor of Britain entering the war alongside America, but he also can't resist a great story, so the paper's reputation is certainly at stake. The genius way that they verify this memo is inspiring and thrilling to would-be investigative reporters. It's phenomenal, and it's so impressive. And considering the film isn't paced like a thriller or with any real urgency, it still manages to kind of get your blood boiling a little bit. The third part of the story belongs to the law office that defends Catherine when she's finally identified. Ray Fiennes plays the very practical, low-key attorney, Ben Emerson, who doesn't believe in big dramatic moments, but instead dives deep into the timing of Britain's official stance that the war in Iraq was no longer illegal. For a long time they said it was, and then suddenly they said it wasn't, and he and his team look into why that happened and when that happened, and it makes a huge difference. There's not really any weak link on the acting front in Official Secrets, and that's kind of key because, like I said, the material can be a little dry, which is not to say it's emotionless. It's definitely not. Knightley gives a really powerful, very impassioned performance that is also her attempting to capture a woman who doesn't want her decision to be thought of as impulsive. She's not trying to get her name in the paper. She's just trying to be an advocate for the truth. So if Official Secrets has moments where it does diverge from the truth, it feels honest in capturing Gunn's story, the journalists, the attorneys who contributed to these historic events, of which I'm guessing most Americans aren't even aware of. I certainly wasn't. The film features the type of sort of solid, no-frill storytelling that should be celebrated and embraced more often. In fact, there's a movie coming out in November called The Report with Adam Driver that also follows this manner of storytelling. Actually, kind of reminded me of that a little bit, although Driver is working more on the inside. It's very natural, it's very honest, and the results are impressive in both cases. So I would say give both of them a shot.
Okay. That's Official Secrets, which is out right now. All right. Well, $91 million over the weekend. It Chapter 2 has made $91 million. Steve, tell us about It Chapter 2.
Are we sure we can't get Eric there to do this? No. All right.
It's inevitable. We got to talk about it.
All right, now there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot of movie here. In many ways, it's kind of remarkable that you can make what is effectively a single story told in two parts with the same creative team throughout, and still come up with two films that I felt were quite different in many, many ways.
I agree with you 100%.
It is still based on Stephen King's epic novel. It Chapter 2 reunites the core group of characters from the first film, but 27 years later, pushing the ages of the self-described Losers Club well into their 30s and maybe even 40s. When they last saw each other back home in Deary, Maine, they had defeated, at least temporarily, the evil clown Pennywise, still played by Bill Skarsgård. And the memories of those horrid days were beginning to fade as they got further outside of Deary. But lucky us, we only had to wait 2 years for director Andy Muschietti and screenwriter Gary Dauberman, who did the last two Annabelle movies. He did the last It movie, obviously. He did The Nun. We had to complete this battle between this group of outcasts and this demon clown. So part of the reason It Chapter 2 is so different is that the cast has effectively doubled, or one of the reasons. We have adult counterparts for each of the seven original kids. And thanks to a bunch of flashbacks, both of moments we saw in the first film and a whole bunch of moments we didn't see in the first film, the filmmakers used the younger versions of the Losers Club quite a bit more than I was expecting. And I think to mostly good effect, since most of those kids were really good in Chapter 1. As you probably heard by now, the film is considerably longer. It's pushing 3 hours, which I didn't know when I walked into it a couple weeks ago. And there's really no getting around the fact that's going to bug the hell out of a lot of people just on principle. But honestly, I got to say, the running time was never really an issue for me. Not much of this feels like padding, but that's not always necessarily a good thing. The film begins with a series of phone calls that Mike Hanlon, who's the only member of the original gang who stayed in Deary, and because of that, his memories of their confrontation with Pennywise haven't faded as much. But it's really fun to just watch him call all of these people and just say, you have to come home, and they don't even think twice about it. They just come. It's 27 years later. Kids have started disappearing again or turning up dead. So he believes it's time to call everyone together. Since they were the one who defeated Pennywise the first time, he thinks they can do it again. James McAvoy is here playing the group's leader, Bill. He's a best-selling author. Bill Hader is the smart-mouth Richie, who's now a well-known stand-up comic. Jessica Chastain is the sole female. Beverly, who seems to have married Rich, but seems also to be drawn to men who abuse her, not unlike her father did. Jay Ryan plays Ben, the former fat kid who's now ridiculously handsome and fit. James Ransom, I think the always underrated James Ransom, plays Eddie, the sickly kid with the oppressive mother, who grew up with an oppressive mother and has now apparently traded her in for a oppressive, nagging wife, who actually is played by the same actress that played his mother in the first film. I don't know if you caught that, Nick.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
But, yeah, so... And then there's an actor named Andy Bean who plays Stanley, who is perhaps the most unnerved by the initial phone call requesting the homecoming, and that's all I'm going to say about that. The group eventually reconvenes back in Deary, and it doesn't take long for Pennywise to make his presence known.
Okay, Steve, hang on.
Okay,
hang
sure,
on.
Sure.
We got to take a break. We'll come back, and Steve will continue telling us about It Chapter 2, and then I'll tell you what I thought of it as well. All right, we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back after this. I'm 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress is in Toronto at the Toronto Film Festival. We'll hear from him tomorrow. His schedule is crazy right now, so he won't be able to join us. He couldn't join us this morning. Steve Procopi is with us, and before the break, we were talking about It Chapter 2. And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, continue. It Chapter 2.
So, you know, I think it starts out fairly strong. But it does set a very different tone than the first film. For even though the first one had a fairly large cast too, it still managed to feel like a more intimate, personal, psychological attack on each of these children and the things that scared them personally. And the results were a handful of really terrifying sequences in some cases that played off these personal fears. But in this grown-up version of things, the filmmakers seem more intent on something a little more playful and exciting and fun and a lot less intimate in terms of the scares. There's more big set pieces. There's noticeable special effects and imagery, repeating imagery that has already become like a huge part of the pop culture lexicon to a point where it's kind of ceased being scary. And I'm sorry, folks, but like red balloons aren't doing it for me anymore. So, And you know, neither is like a kid in a yellow raincoat. It just isn't doing it. And you know, I'm all for, obviously we're all for R-rated horror movies becoming part of the popular culture and capturing the imagination of everybody. But you know, this new version of Pennywise has entered the lexicon of film history forever, but as a result, there sort of has a price, and the price is that Pennywise isn't as scary as he once was. Skarsgård still has a great deal to offer, I think, but there's actually a sequence in here where Pennywise sort of lures a little girl under the bleachers for murderous purposes, and it's a very simply executed moment without a lot of flash. Again, it's that personal touch that works beautifully when it's used, and it's rarely used here. I wish there had been more of that. But the filmmakers turned him into some giant-sized monster, and it looks really cool, but it didn't really fill me with a lot of fear. There are some touches in the film where Machete seems to be invoking Evil Dead 2, and I think even more glaringly, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yep.
But I will say this, like, at first I thought they were just trying to get away with it, and then Bill Hader says something at the end of that scene, was like, oh, wait, they're acknowledging it. Okay, and that is very in line with the way the book was. Some of these kids, their deepest fears were horror movies that they saw, so that's fine with me. I'm okay with that. They're not trying to, like, sneak it past us. It's there. They're acknowledging it. Fine. The adult cast is fairly solid all around, although I got to say Hader and I said James Ransom really stand out as actually adding some depth to these somewhat jaded characters, McAvoy and Chastain, who are reunited from Dark Phoenix, which nobody wants, just seem to be sort of building upon what their younger counterparts began much more convincingly. There actually came a point where I started to really eagerly await flashbacks because I wanted to see the stuff set in the 80s again. Look, the movie is expertly made. The production design is phenomenal. There are a few nice touches here and there with some supporting cast members. But when the adults are sort of forced to split up and find these tokens of their childhood selves in order to defeat Pennywise, It just feels like a video game where, like, each person has to pick up a trinket and of no particular value, and it's just a drawn-out exercise in trying to get everybody back together. And if the film does drag, it's in that sort of middle section. Maybe if you watch the films back-to-back, it'll feel more like a whole, but as it stands, It Chapter 2 feels lesser by a large factor. It was a fairly large disappointment with just a couple nuggets of exception. But yeah, I cannot quite recommend it.
Yeah, I thought it sucked, and it was endless, man. I mean, it's so long and needlessly. I didn't care about the characters. I really like the first one a lot. I think the first It is a really cool movie.
Same, yeah.
And it's scary, and I love the kids in it. And it was good and R-rated in all the right ways. This just seems completely forced. Everything about it seems forced. The only thing in the movie that I really, really liked was Hader. I thought Bill Hader was great in it. But, he's just, the guy's having a banner couple of years, Bill Hader, and he should keep riding that
yeah.
wave. Jessica Chastain, who I really, adored. It's the second time she's worked with this guy because he directed Mama. And she was great in that movie. And that was a scary movie. I just thought this movie was bloated. Everything about it. I didn't care about, I really didn't care about the adults and that. And you're right, where they're sent on these missions, to find these tokens. It takes forever.
yeah.
It just takes forever. It's a great cast, most of them wasted. James McAvoy, who is one of my favorite actors on the planet, he has nothing to work with. In this movie, and I quite frankly, I'm a little tired of Pennywise at this point. And like you said, the red balloon stuff. So the effects are great, like you said, it's beautifully photographed, but all for naught, man. I just didn't care at all, and it just felt like it would never end. And it wasn't particularly scary either. So, I thought it sucked. I was very, very, very disappointed considering how much I enjoyed the first one. So,
yeah.
Yeah. All right. So do not see It Chapter 2, but, nobody's listening because it made $91 million.
But here's the thing. People are still going to see just to finish it out. You kind of have to, don't you? As much as you don't want to, but you almost have to. And that's the sickening part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
I almost wish they'd made them back to back. I feel like because they might have gotten more money. I feel like that 2-year gap, I wish they'd almost done it all at once, put them out in consecutive years. I bet it would have felt a little more tonally right.
Yeah.
But who knows? Who the hell knows?
Yeah. Anyway, so I was very disappointed. I'm looking at the box office, and so it made $91 million. It was number one at the box office. That's
which is less than the first one.
Is it? Is it really?
For the first weekend, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
I can tell you. I wasn't prepared to talk about box. Oh. Okay, well, it made 185 globally, but the first one made 123 million in its opening weekend,
and just in America.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, yeah. Man, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I'm just looking also at some of the other box office stuff here. I'm just happy. I'm looking at the numbers. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is now up to $62 million.
Yeah.
And that makes me happy, considering that I want a sequel.
there will be. I have no doubt about that.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
and Ready or Not's not doing bad either.
No,
for how
Ready
much
or Not.
It costs.
No, exactly. Ready or Not.
I'm also really excited. The Peanut Butter Falcon is still in there. It's still in the top 10 because I love that movie. It's actually made a decent amount of money. I know it didn't cost anything. So
yeah. No, and it went from number 12 to number 7 this week.
Yeah, no, it gained theaters, a few theaters, and it only went down 25%. So
yeah, that's good.
I'm very happy
stuff.
With that.
Very, very cool. All right, what is next week? What do we got?
Hustlers.
Oh,
come on.
God.
And no, I'll tell you, the word out of Toronto is this thing is solid. And I will say, the writer-director, Lorraine Scafaria, I think she's a terrific filmmaker. She did a little thing a few years ago called Seeking Friends for the End of the World.
Oh, yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, this is her. She did one in between, I'm forgetting the title of, but the one with Susan Sarandon and Rose Byrne. I'm trying to remember. The Meddler, called.
Right.
So this is her newest film. This is her third film, and I think she's a real talent. And from what I've heard, they kill this one. So I'm excited.
Okay.
I wasn't before. I'm like you. I'm like, oh boy.
Yeah.
And the Goldfinch is opening next week.
Yeah, the Goldfinch opens next week too. Yeah.
And I went out. I'll point two smaller films out that you should try to check out. Or people, if you like films about kids in distress, a horror film. There's a little Mexican film coming out next week called Tigers Are Not Afraid. That was killed on the festival circuit last year. It is phenomenal. It is really good. And then there's a terrific documentary about Linda Ronstadt coming out next week called Sound of My Voice. And I'll tell you, just looking at the box office, it had the second highest per screen average this week behind It Chapter 2.
There you go. All right.
It is really, really good, and again, it'll make you cry. And she's not even dead, and it'll still make you cry.
Yeah, absolutely. All right.
Anyway,
well, Steve, thanks, man.
Yeah,
and
of course.
We'll talk to you next week.
All right, take care, man.
There you go. Steve Procopi, everybody. And he will be joining us again next week. Eric will be back next week. He's in Toronto right now, and we will get a report from Eric Childress live in Toronto with all of the latest movies that he's seeing up there. We'll get a nice preview of all that cool stuff. So, and then back to the regular Monday morning movie reviews for next week. All right, let's take a break here on 720 WGN.